there was something exciting about Jesus. There was something different about him. The words he shared, the stories he shared that attracted people from all walks of life. They were coming from everywhere. They were literally dropping what they were doing and following him because they had never heard or seen anyone quite like him. There was something about his personality that drew large crowds as he traveled. Can you imagine what that was like? We know some of the stories, the feeding of the 5,000. Can you imagine 5,000 people walking along trying to hear what this man is trying to say? How the disciples, those 12 men, were probably a little frustrated because they were trying to learn at his feet, and yet as he was walking along, more and more people came. It was amazing. What was it that drew them? It was likely this power of God that came from his every word, this authority, this new authority which he spoke, as one person and another person said, "We've never heard anyone speak like this before." Or maybe it was that he brought good news when there was so much bad news in the headlines. Maybe that's why the Greeks called his message the good news. There was something captivating about Jesus and the message that he shared. Now, this being said, however, it's important to note that not everybody who followed Jesus was there for the same reason. There were lots of reasons to follow him. Some followed because they were curious. They saw a large crowd of people and they said, "I wonder what's up. So I got to check this out." A couple weeks ago, Mindy and I were at Myrtle Beach, and as we were sitting there watching the waves and watching people kind of scattered all over the beach, suddenly a crowd started to appear, and more people. And there was this huddle of probably 50 or 60 people on the beach. And being the curious people we are, we sat there and said, "We'll figure it out later." I thought, wonder what it is that's bringing them over there. Is somebody hurt? Did something happen? The lifeguard doesn't seem to be going over there. Finally, a woman who ran to get her camera and then was there for a few minutes came back and she looked at us and said, "They found a hermit crab." But people were fascinated. They saw something happening. They wanted to know what it was like. It's like when you go to New York City, one thing you're told not to do is to stand there and look up at the buildings. Because before you know it, you're going to have a crowd of people going, "Is someone jumping? What's going on up there?" It's really easy to do. People are fascinated. They want to know what's going on. So some were curious onlookers. Some were spies. They were from the camp of the religious leaders, the government officials, who really didn't like what Jesus was saying. They didn't like that he was stirring up the crowds, making them think that there was someone else that they should give their allegiance to. They wanted to see if there was something that they could take back and report about Jesus. Did he say something he shouldn't have said? Will they get in trouble this time? They wanted to know. Some people heard that Jesus was a healer. They'd heard amazing stories. They might have known someone who had been healed. They might have known someone who had come back to life. And so they followed him. They wanted to be healed. They were looking for hope. And some followed just because they wanted to commit themselves to being a disciple. They wanted to glean the new life, a new life direction from him so that their old life could go away and they could be somebody new, that they could learn to be closer to God. They wanted to be a disciple. Now, when I say disciple, I'm not talking about those 12 disciples that we know their names, but we're talking about people who follow. We're all called to be disciples. I'm speaking about the masses of the people, the women, the men, even the children who came to gather around him, to sit at his feet and to listen. They wanted to know about this message that they could then take and turn their lives around. There were droves of them, and what they believed about Jesus was probably very different from each other. We really don't know what all of them understood or did not understand, but they had committed themselves to follow him and to learn from him as they too journeyed with him wherever he was going. So no doubt the masses were, there were some new converts. There were some contemplating about the possibility about becoming disciples. There were some who probably heard his words and said, "Martha, did he just say that? I don't think I can do this. Yeah, let's go home." Okay. In the context, Jesus addressed the multitude. In no uncertain terms, he wanted them not only to hear good news, but to know what they were getting into. To be a disciple meant there were certain things you need to do, and there were many things you should not do. So Luke gives us in just, wow, 7-8 verses, three short parables that probably thinned the crowd a little bit, because what he was saying, as some theologians have called, hard sayings, but others have called them parables of grace. He made three strong cannot statements, and those statements have to do with commitment and with sacrifice and with generosity. So Jesus is walking, and he turns to the crowds and says, whoever comes to me who does not hate their father or their mother, their wife or their children, their brothers or their sisters, who doesn't even hate themselves, cannot be my disciple. You can just imagine the crowds going, what? Did he really say we're supposed to hate mom? We're supposed to hate our dad? We have to hate ourselves in order to be a disciple? What does that mean? Hate? I know they're annoying, but hate them? Really? And so they listen again. And we have to listen in a different way, because the translation for us needs to be worked out a little bit. Sometimes our English translation loses the depth and the breadth and the meaning of the original translation, the original words. What he means by hate means to probably not love as much, that we need to give our commitment to Jesus. So he's not talking about hate in the sense of intense anger or strong hostility. He's setting up this love-hate dichotomy that's more like a loyalty to a sports team. Now, I'm sure that some of you are avid sports fans. You have your team. You love your team. You'll do anything for that team. You'll pay enormous prices to go see those games. You'll buy their shirts, all that stuff. You will watch the TV. You won't miss a game. You are devoted to that team. And yet, there's also that other team. In this part of the state, we often refer to another team as that team up north. We won't even say their name. We hate that team up north. So Jesus is saying, okay, you can love your team. You can be loyal to them. You can be committed to them. But you don't really hate that team up north. You may not know any of them personally. You may not know anything about them. You just are not going to commit to them the same way you're going to commit to the Buckeyes. And that's a disease in itself. When we were in Myrtle Beach, we were on this carriage tour. And the woman who was getting us loaded up on one of the carriages said, that man over there wants everyone to know he's from Ohio. He had a Buckeye shirt on. And so I turn and say, go Bucks. His response, O-H. And of course, Mindy says, I-O. And everybody around us said, what? We can support our favorite team. We can love them, but we don't really hate the other team. We can say we hate Michigan. We don't really hate them. Now, if someone actually does hate them, is really hostile against them, has this, wants to be violent about it, they might need some professional help. But for the most part, we don't hate them. We're just not committed to that team. When I lived in Ann Arbor, it was very difficult. I did put my Buckeye flag out on my garage. It was the year that they won the national championship. I was in Michigan for 3 years. I told Mindy this yesterday, and she said, you did not do that. I put it out there, and every Sunday after the Michigan-Ohio State game, we sang, Come Christians Join to Serve, which is Carmen, Ohio. I did not tell the people in that church I was serving in Ann Arbor that that's what I was doing, but I enjoyed it anyway. So we are called to be committed. We are called to be one with Jesus. Jesus is the one who says, if you're going to go over there, remember, I'm the one. He's the one with the big foam finger going, hey, it's me. I'm number one. Follow me. You can love them. But if they're going one way and I'm going the other, come my way. I've got a better way. The crowd around Jesus probably committed. I really can't commit to that. Some of them said, yes. I can do that. I can love my family, but I love you more, and take me where you will. Commitment. That's what Jesus is talking about when he says, hate your mom and dad. He's not really saying that. And then there's sacrifice. Jesus goes on to say, whoever does not carry the cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. He's making it crystal clear that you can't truly be a disciple unless you're willing to sacrifice for what you believe in. For each of us, sacrifice may be a little bit different. It might be a sacrifice of time or energy. It might be a sacrifice of a gift. It might be a financial sacrifice. It might be giving up a habit or a hobby or a career path to commit ourselves to follow Jesus, to give our lives to Jesus. You know, I've been blessed to meet a lot of interesting people in my life. I want to share about one person with you. He would be astounded that I'm even going to mention his name in a worship service on a Sunday morning. His name is Joe Cusack. Joe and I met 30 years ago, about this time of the year. We were brand new juniors in seminary. It's a great thing about seminary. Your first year, you're a junior, so you don't have to be that freshman or sophomore anymore. You're a junior. But then you realize quickly what junior means. We were brand new. Joe was there. And as we got to know each other, we shared our stories about why we were there, about the call we had and how we had given up and sacrificed and how we'd committed to something else. And then when Joe told his story, we all felt like, oh yeah, well, I guess I didn't do much of anything then. Joe is amazing. Joe Cusack from Totowa, New Jersey. Joe had the thickest accent you ever heard, and he would tell stories, and you'd sit there and go, wow. He said on his wedding night, he and his wife were not sure what to do with their lives, and they opened up a Gideon Bible. I've never heard anyone say this in before. Actually opened up a Gideon Bible and read it, and Joe said, I felt called to serve God, and they decided he was going to go to seminary. Now, for Joe, that was a little bit different because Joe had not finished high school. Joe had a learning disability. It took a long time. So he had to get his GED. He had to find a college that would work with him. It took him 6-7 years to get through college. And then there was seminary. Typically, a seminary can go through 3 or 4 years. It took Joe about 5 years. The particular seminary we went to, you had to have Greek and Hebrew. So you had to pass a Greek proficiency in order to be even accepted into the seminary. And so as I was suffering through it, I thought, how in the world did Joe do this? So what took me a relatively short time in the scheme of things, it took Joe like 12 years from the time he was called to say, I'm going to go to seminary, I'm going to serve God, I'm going to go to a church, and I'm going to give my life to Jesus. Wow. Do you have that commitment? Could you sacrifice that much? Would you be that generous with your time? And that's the third story where Jesus talks about generosity. He wants to make a point that only a fool will start a project he can't finish. Joe said his family thought he was awfully foolish. But he said, I'm committed. I can do this. I have support and I have faith. Sometimes we have to look blindly at the future and trust in God. For many years over my desk when I paid bills, we had this little card above the desk. Faith is living on invisible means of support. So every time we got the checkbook out, I would read that. Faith means living on invisible means of support. Dear God, I need something. It was amazing how often that came through. We are also called to be generous, to give even when we don't think we have enough to give. And that's the irony of generosity, is when you give, you receive so much more. When you give of yourself your time, you get so much more back. When you give, when you think, I can't even afford to give this, something happens and it touches your life in a much special way. When you feed a child who's hungry, when you work with a refugee, when you work with a family who's really down and out and doesn't know what to do, when you give your time of day, when you smile at someone, when you see someone who tells their life story, and you don't sit there and say, yeah, I hear you, listen to mine. We don't do that. We give to them. We scratch the surface here a little bit. We're giving musical instruments. We've given buckets to help clean up. We've given some money. We've given some time. I think we can do a whole lot more, and God will bless us. God calls us to radical hospitality and generosity to make a difference in the world, even if it's simply making the difference in the life of one person, in that one world. We can do some of that, and we can do more. You and I are called to be disciples. Disciples of the one who teaches us about the amazing love of God, who asks us to do things we think we can't do, but who gives us people, a church, a faith, so that we can do amazing things. I used to tell people that my understanding of God was that Jesus came to turn my world upside down so that it might be right side up. May we be the disciples who, when we look at the world, we see it through the eyes of Jesus, so we can see this upside down world turned right side up so that God can use us. Jesus calls us. Let us follow. Thanks be to God. Amen.